From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight in Denver, two men will stand up to debate for the U.S. presidency, the highest office in the land. Another man will ask the question, looks like patriarchy unruffled. But pull the camera back, says my guest today, Hannah Rosin, and it's a different picture. Her new book is The End of Men and the Rise of Women, Matriarchy. My guest, Stephanie Kuntz, says not so fast. Her essay rebuttal is The Myth of Male Decline. They're with us. This hour on Point, The End of Men or Not. You can join the conversation. What is going on with gender roles, status, power in our society? Are women adapting better to the new economy? Are men taking a tumble? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll talk with James Fallows about tonight's presidential debate, and Stephanie Kuntz will join us in just a few minutes. But first, joining us from Washington is Hannah Rosin, senior editor at The Atlantic, founder and editor at Double X, Slate's offering for women. Her new book, raising lots of conversation, is The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Hannah, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
So we know there's a debate here, and it's a really interesting and subtle one, and I look forward to it. Stephanie Kuntz is going to join us in a moment. But lay out your case for us, Hannah. You say we've got, at least in the middle class and maybe beyond, almost a matriarchy on the rise here, a real sort of historical shift in power status. What's going on?
Well, so I don't want to present this as a triumphalist feminist manifesto because a lot of what I write in the book is, heartbreaking. Like, this upheaval in gender roles does not sit well with a lot of men or women and has created a lot of problems. But it does have to do with adaptability. So what I'm writing about is the question of whether women are adapting better to some of the changes that are happening in this economy.
To say the least. I mean, adapting better, but that means taking more responsibility, taking more power and leadership roles from all kinds of settings to the home and way, way beyond.
Yeah. So I'm talking about the workplace. I'm talking about largely college education. Women are much more successful these days at getting college degrees, and college degrees are very necessary to establish yourself in the middle class and, you know, in this economy. And then I'm talking also about professional degrees. I mean, women in law school, women going to medical school in greater numbers. And then in the sort of middle bottom of the economy, I describe it almost as a sisterhood of the economy, because as more women at the top go to school, they open up jobs of things that women used to do for free, which take advantage of traditional feminine traits, we could say, like childcare or elder care or food preparation, that kind of thing.
So you're talking about an enormous change. You talk about the depths men have sunk to. Women, for the first time in history, you say, had in many ways in recent years surpassed them. You say there's no going back. You write, I realized the evidence was everywhere, and it was only centuries of habit and history that prevented everyone from seeing it. Give us some more definition of what it is. What is it that we're not seeing, but it's right in front of us?
Well, so a lot of it is cultural changes, changing definitions of, you know, what a man and woman do within the family. I think economic changes often bring on cultural changes. So you see pretty profoundly a shifting definitions of marriage. And, for example, I write about how in the college-educated classes we have a more equal model of marriage. It's nothing like it was in 1962, where people felt trapped, like a woman felt trapped. That was the Betty Friedan moment, you know, trapped at home. And men, you know, like in the novel Revolutionary Road, felt trapped as the breadwinner, and they felt like there was a noose around them. And now that we've loosened up those roles, those marriages are much more stable and happy than they ever have been. You know, the college classes are now the standard bearers of marriage. And then for people who don't have a college degree, this is where the picture gets a little more dicey. You have a lot fewer people getting married, and I think that's because a lot fewer men are working or in the workforce now than have been in a really long time. And so the families are kind of breaking apart. I mean, you have women leading the families, doing essentially everything, for better or worse, going to school, raising the kids, trying to work. I write in the book about an enduring image of that I was doing some reporting in a community college, because in community college, the disparity between men and women can be really vast. I mean, there's many community colleges which are 70-75% women, largely because they're training women for the health fields.
But you take that as a proxy for women's sort of readiness to go out and learn whatever they need to learn to get into this economy.
Well, I guess I think there's two ways to look at that. You know, there's one way to look at it and say those aren't the greatest jobs. They don't pay well. And these women are staying poor because they have so much more responsibility. I don't think that's false. I think that's true. On the other hand, I also think you can look at it as those are the available jobs in this economy. Those are, if you were to go ask a counselor, you know, what field should I get into where I can get a job? Let's say you're about to go to community college. They would rightly steer you towards the healthcare field because those are growing fields. So I think we've often seen that as ghettoization of women, and we'll talk about that more later in the show. But but I see it as making intelligent choices about this economy and what is available to you.
The key thing that you point to here, as I read you, Hannah, is what you call plastic women, plastic in the sense not of fake, but of flexible, and cardboard men. And an economy that's asking for a lot of change and flexibility, and men have by your description, shown themselves less willing or able to make the adaptations to get along in this new economy. Women quite willing, and it's showing up in results.
Yes, and I don't think these are inherent characteristics. I resist that throughout the book. You know, I often talk about how after World War II, men were very flexible when the GI Bill was passed, and they were not only flexible, they had a kind of urgency to reestablish themselves. And so they came back with gusto, went to school, you know, took jobs in offices, took over farms. There have been moments of great elasticity. It's just this one happens to be a moment of, you know, greater adaptability on the part of women. And I think part of what's driving women is the feeling of being marginalized, that they have to work twice as hard, you know, to get to make it and still make it to the top. I think you need a lot of the women I write about feel like immigrants, like they feel like my own immigrant parents. Like there's something driving them forward, and it's the fact that they are not settled. They don't have what we call patriarchal privilege, so that drives them to work super duper hard.
You say that fewer people getting married, men no longer acting in many cases as the main domestic provider. You're right. They lost the old architecture of manliness. It's not just their job, not just the status as breadwinner, but the architecture of manliness itself lost. What does that mean?
So if you think about the convention, since we do have the debate tonight, you notice that both parties talk about the manufacturing sector a lot. And I think they do that not because the manufacturing sector is playing such a huge role in our economy, because it's playing less and less of a role. I think they do that because that's a substitute for a conversation in America about manhood and where are our archetypes of manhood. This is a century-long conversation we've been having in America, and I think it's especially urgent now. And I also think what I write in the book, it can go in two totally different directions. You know, I write about this town in the South where the men have had one definition of manhood as informed by this job in the manufacturing sector, and they're having a hard time letting go of that. And so they're having a hard time kind of adjusting to the jobs that are available. On the other hand, you know, there are many people who see this as extremely positive and long overdue. The idea that, as we're just starting to see now in movies and TV, men can ease off a little bit. They can be more domesticated. And that is not emasculating. You know, there can be sitcoms about men who take care of their children and they're not complete boobs. You know, they are sexy, attractive,
not
wonderful men.
Not such a tight definition, not such a narrow definition of manliness emerging there.
Exactly. And I think that's a positive thing. I mean, I often say that, what's at the other side of the end of men for my two sons? Because I have two sons and a daughter. It's that my son can, you know, marry a woman or date a woman who makes more money than he does. He can decide to work 4 days a week and nobody cares. Nobody thinks there's anything wrong with him. And so it's a lot of it is about freedom of choice for me, sort of letting people breathe a little bit, having a little imagination about what people can do is the good result of what I'm describing.
You are not shy about pointing out what a big, big change this may be. I mean, after all, it's been thousands of years of patriarchy. You write that, in fact, what we're seeing now is, you write, there is no natural order, only the way things are. And you say, lately, we are starting to see how quickly an order we once considered natural, i.e. patriarchy, can be overturned. What's that look like?
So what if you zoom out and look at the trends over 100 years, they all seem to be pointing in one direction, which is that women are adapting. You know, things like the wage gap are closing very slowly and spottily, but still closing. And, you know, whereas men are not really adapting, you know, I mean, at the end, the happy end of this is actually probably convergence more than, you know, a sort
convergence
of dominant
roles, of
exactly.
Characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think where you have traits that are not men's traits and women's traits, but that we would define as, say, traditionally masculine and traditionally feminine, but that anyone can choose from those traits. Exactly. And maybe that's too utopian. I'm not really sure. But, you know, as I said, like, we look at matriarchy as I described it, say, in the working class and middle class. That's not a good picture. Like, ultimately, what people want is connection. You know, they want to be together. This is how people tend to gravitate. I mean, I'm going to say something so corny here, but I think about the way the Hunger Games series ends, where you have a woman, a young female heroine, who's the embodiment of so many male warrior virtues, you know, ends up with a man who's the embodiment of so many feminine nurturing virtues. Like, he's the baker and he's the charmer and he reaches out, and they end up together because ultimately they need each other, even though neither of them, you know, they're essentially choosing from a menu, that hero and heroine of that story. So that's maybe a happy ending.
Tell me how you feel about this. Do it I want if I wanna live. I worked hard and sacrificed to get what I get. Ladies, it ain't easy being independent. Question, how'd you like this knowledge that I brought? Bragging on that cash that he gave you is the front. If you're gonna brag, make sure it's your money you fund. Depend on no one else to give you what you want. Shoes on my feet, I'm wearing, I'm wearing the rock on my game.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the buzz and debate about the end of men and the rise of women. The book, the idea, the reality that men are off their game lately and more women are hitting their stride, or at least picking up the slack. Hannah Rosen, author of The End of Men, is with us today. We're going to hear in just a moment from Stephanie Kuntz, who's got some pushing back to do and an interesting conversation, I'm sure. Hannah Rosen is in Washington with us. She mentioned the Hunger Games. Here's a little scene from that. The protagonist, the smart, resourceful, brave, skilled Katniss Evergreen, female. She is also a little lacking in social graces, a new kind of heroine, crossing gender roles a little. Here is Jennifer Lawrence playing Katniss in the film adaptation. She's saying goodbye to her younger sister and her mother after she's volunteered to take her sister's place in the deadly games.
Just trying to win. Maybe you can.
Maybe I can. I am smart, you know.
You can hunt.
Exactly. You can't tune out again. Not like when Dad died. I won't be there anymore. You're all she has. No matter what you feel, you have to be there for her. Do you understand? Don't cry.
I'm smart. You can hunt. Don't cry. It's like Cowboy Shane writing off a generation ago. And here another little bit. This is 2009. Popular culture is picking up on all this. TV sitcom Better Off Ted satirizes office culture. The boss is Veronica Palmer, played by Portia de Rossi. Her character is intimidating, unsympathetic, harsh. In one episode, she's worried about whether she's the rightful recipient of a promotion. Her colleague Ted, played by Jay Harrington, was able to find proof.
When I was in HR, I dug up this old memo about your promotion. All the executives had to sign off on it.
Really? I know we agreed not to let women into upper management, but Veronica Palmer is man smart. And hello, as she breaks through the glass ceiling, we can all look up her skirt. Oh my God, that promotion was mine.
Okay, it's messy, but Veronica Palmer is man smart there from Better Off Ted. Hannah Rosen is with us from Washington, D.C., and from Olympia, Washington, right now. Stephanie Kuntz joins us. She teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College. Her essay, Rebuttal, Really, The Myth of Male Decline, appeared in the New York Times on Sunday. Stephanie Kuntz, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you. What do you make of the end of men? What's your message?
Thanks, Tom. Well, I think it's really important to understand that there's very little difference. When you look, my rebuttal was not so much to Hannah's book as to the kind of headlines that had been picked from it, and a whole spurt of, you know, sort of hyperbolic book titles that have come out about the end of men, the richer sex, that, you know, men are losing ground, men are in decline. Let me start by, a popular radio show wouldn't like this, but I know you'll accept it.
All right.
Mostly we agree with each other. My last book, A Strange Stirring, was just about how big a revolution there's been, just not in the last 100 or 1,000 years, just in the last 50 years. So Hannah and I completely agree on how much we've progressed, how much we've totally overthrown the old discriminatory laws and many of the attitudes. We also agree on the limits of that progress and on the possibility of even further change. It's really a question of nuance and phrasing. There are a few, you know, I don't like the word matriarchy. I'm hesitant to say that, and we can come back to this, but just I'll say it in passing now, mm-hmm. that women are more flexible and are adapting better than men. I do know that men are having many problems. Partly, and Hannah and I agree on this, partly because of a punishing new economic climate, and partly because many men find it difficult to give up that sense of, well, the way to succeed is through the traditional masculine ways. But I think that it's more complicated than that, that some of the changes are not irreversible. We did see a stall in attitudes toward gender equality in the 90s, despite a tremendous change in both sexes. And by the way, men are adapting remarkably, I think, in both their behavior and their attitudes toward women. And my fear is that the end of men and matriarchy and richer sex phrases actually lend credence to something Hannah and I both abhor, the idea that women gain at the expense of men. When you read Hannah's book, she makes all these points in here, but the excerpts from it and the way it's been played by the popular press make me a little nervous.
Well, okay, so we're not looking for girl fight, cat fight here. On the other hand, you're objecting to the headline title, you know, The End of Men. You're objecting to the notion of women more flexible. You're objecting to the idea of matriarchy, and all those are at the heart of what Hannah's writing here.
Well, I'm not sure they're at the heart. I don't think Hannah would think they're at the heart because she has a very good explanation of the limits that women still face and the extent to which men have the real possibility and are showing signs of overcoming this for the benefit of both. But yes, let's take a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take, for example, the idea that women are adapting better than men. I'm always nervous about that, and I know Hannah does not have an essentialist idea that, oh, men and women are
yep.
fundamentally different and women are the nurturing, flexible, wonderful sex and men are not.
Mm-hmm.
But look, for example, at the very correct point she makes about how women's focus on health care and other caring professions, which are traditionally female professions, has been really good for them in this changing economy. Well, is that because they're more flexible and nimble? The other possibility is that both men and women are still tied in to sort of traditional ideas about what they should be, but that women's tendency to go into feminine fields of education and work, unlike men's, happens to be working for us in this new economy. In the last recession, of course, men lost 80% of the jobs in the beginning of it,
mm-hmm.
precisely because they were focused in construction and finance. But it's interesting that since then, in the so-called recovery, with the ripple effects of the recession and the layoffs in government, women have been losing more jobs than men. So in one sense, it's not so much that we nimbly got into new jobs, but that some of the traditional female fields that we were socialized to go into have been expanding, but others have been contracting.
Stephanie, if I may, Hannah's got a whole chapter, and we'll ask her to speak to it, called The New American Matriarchy. Now, she roots that in the middle class, where there's a bunch of reasons that women are taking on more responsibility there. There's less marriage, and guys have had more trouble being the breadwinner. There's a lot of uncertainty there. That's certainly a kind of day-to-day power and responsibility. But
well,
you point, if I may, to the Fortune 500, is it? Only 4% of CEOs there are women at this point. So if we're talking about sort of who's in charge, what matters here? Is it the household? Is it Fortune 500? Is it all of the above?
Well, you see, when you come to the household, I think that I would call it the new American equality, that there's a real give and take between men and women. Yes, some women earn more than their husbands, are usually not a lot more than their husbands. The ones who do earn a lot more than their husbands, it turns out, actually get more help from their husbands at home, and not because they're imposing it on their husbands. Men in those marriages and who choose those roles, despite, as Hannah said, some of them finding it a difficult transition, actually end up reporting themselves happier in their marriages. So I think we are seeing an absolute revolution in terms of equality. And equality means that in some individual situations, women can lead in a way that was absolutely impossible just 50 years ago. But it doesn't mean that they're in charge.
Hannah, how about it? It's not the new American matriarchy, Stephanie says. It's the new American equality.
I think that's true in different classes. So in the book, I divide the what's happening in marriages and between men and women into two classes, because I think she's right about the college-educated class. It's actually kind of a beautiful picture. I mean, it is a picture of equality and trading off. I mean, at its absolute ideal, of course, not every marriage works out that way, and women do end up with a lot more childcare. But that is a prettier picture than in the other chapter where, I mean, the way sociologists describe it is exactly what we saw in the inner city African-American community where after William Julius Wilson's book, When Work Disappears, where the factories left the inner city and then men had a hard time finding their footing. So that's about almost exactly what's happening in the town that I describe in Alabama, where the factory left, you know, that town and then the men are having a hard time finding their footing. So in the book, I sort of go down the generations as you see the effect of that economic change. And by the time you get to the younger generation, you know, you have this couple in which the man is just not stepping up as a father. So again, like, matriarchy is not a triumphalist thing. It's kind of a troublesome thing. It's like not what you want. In fact, many economists describe that as the biggest social disaster we're about to face is the number of men who are not in the workforce and continue not to be in the workforce. So I think they're just too, you know, it's like everything else in America. We live in a very class divided society. So you look at the rise of women and it gets filtered through the class divide. So it looks one way for one set of people and it looks a totally different way for another set of people.
Hannah, Stephanie, I want to turn to our listeners. A lot of them want to join this conversation. Esther is calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Esther. Thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just looked at the sort of narrowness of the conversation in terms of the ascent of women. If you're following along the Half the Sky Foundation and the programming that's about it, looking at the condition of women worldwide, where they're not necessarily represented in the government, the judiciary, as teachers, as police officers, in the military, the situation is still quite different and quite.
You think it's an American exception here, or a first world, if we can still use that phrase, exception, but not global?
I think if we look at where women are again represented in the government, in high position in the judiciary and in positions of power, women who are raped in other countries where there's not that type of representation don't get the same kind of treatment in a country where there are women judges and women lawmakers and some representation there. So I think,
Esther, point taken. This is and this is, in fairness, not a global view here, and it's not presented as any kind of nirvana, even in the United States. But point taken, globally, there's still many challenges for women. Let me hold that one for a moment and get one more. KJ in Clive, Iowa. KJ, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I teach at a state university in the Midwest, and I haven't done a study on this, nor have my colleagues. But I notice, as one of you just said, that the males are relaxing, and I think a bit too much. I mean, I've got my male students sitting in the back of the classroom. They are not engaging, and I'm talking generally here. I certainly have very, you know, diligent male students, but I find that the female students in business communication, in literature courses, they are doing the work, and they're doing fine work, and it's a pleasure to see. It's great. They make connections for me. But the male students, I don't know if it's just a macho thing, you know, it's not hip to study.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm finding.
KJ, we'll speak to your experience. We'll speak to it, and I'm very glad for your call as well. Hannah, we'll come to Esther's point, but speak to KJ here. He's teaching in university, sees guys in the back of the class relaxing too much. He says, you know, maybe studying is not even cool for guys anymore. You've got a lot of that kind of reporting in your book. What's going on?
Yeah, I picked up that vibe from women in colleges, especially big state schools, where they would say, I think one woman said to me, you know, if I get a B, I go home and weep. And if the dudes get a B, you know, they high five each other. Or they would complain that the guys play video games a lot. It's all anecdotal. One thing I wish that I had gotten into, because people have so many theories about this. Like, is it that, you know, the boys are distracted? Does it have to do with the fact that, you know, there are so many female teachers? Does it have to do with the fact that boys at a very young age get the sense that school is rigged against them because girls mature more quickly? I mean, there's so many theories. The one thing I actually
really— But they didn't
really
feel that way, I don't know, in Tom Sawyer times, and it was still school.
You know what's funny about that? Girls always do better in school. Like, if you look at the high school movement at the turn of the century, when, you know, when we started to encourage more people to go to school, girls did graduate from high school at higher rates than boys, even at, you know, just after the turn of the century. But the question is, what did it matter? Like, if 1908, you were smarter, and this comes up in sort of the literature, the novels of that era all the time, where, you know, The Mill and the Floss, where you have the girl is clearly more destined and more suited for academic study. It's just that there wasn't anything to do with that. There weren't that many opportunities. So you kind of need a perfect storm of where the fact that you're really good at school actually makes a difference, and where the patriarchal privilege is not assumed by teachers, which frankly, probably even when I was a kid in school, the teachers sort of assumed that, you know, even if the boys were horsing around, like they were going to be in the leaders of society. And so, you know, so you
soon
sort of
enough
defer to them.
Stephanie, you're in a campus setting. Do you see that? I mean, you say that, you know, there's a kind of danger here of looking at this as cause and effect, that women are taking over, men turn into boys.
Well, I do not think that it's because men turn into boys, and I think probably Hannah and I would agree that I at least think that most of the problems that guys have in school is the lag in their own, in many people's, and I really want to come back to the lower class and how much of a lag there is there. And I also want to point out that men have changed faster in the last 25 years. They have changed as fast as women did in the last 50 years as they try to catch up with these new ideas about gender. But in terms of the guys doing poorly in school, I think the guys who do poorly in school are the ones who have not yet adapted. You know, for 100 years, as Hannah says, you didn't have to do well in school to survive. I mean, we won't name any names, but we have presidents who got C's, you know, in class. Why would I have to achieve? A lot of guys sit there thinking, my goodness, what do I have to do this for? First of all, it's a girly thing. And second of all, I'm going to make it anyway. And those are the guys who are falling behind in every class. But I've just been impressed by the number of guys who are beginning to see these changes even without the pressures of the feminist movement, which we women have the advantage of in changing our consciousness. She got a roping, that's why I love her. Missing it, bending, won't you come and spend a little time? She got a roping, that's why I love her. Missing it, bending, ooh, the way you shine. Missing it, bending. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the buzz and debate about the end of men and the rise of women. The book, the idea, maybe the reality that men are off their game lately and more women are hitting their stride or at least picking up the slack. Hannah Rosen wrote the book. She's with us from Washington. Stephanie Kuntz joins us from Olympia in Washington State. Wrote the big essay, The Myth of Male Decline, just this last weekend, and much more. It's great to have both of them back with us on the air here. Popular culture all over this. The NBC sitcom Up All Night, Will Arnett, Christina Applegate star, as parents to a toddler. Arnett plays Chris, the stay-at-home dad. Applegate plays Regan, the working mom. But Regan ends up losing her job. Roles get reversed. In last week's episode, Chris sets up a home office, and wife Regan takes charge of childcare. But since she's not her daughter's regular caretaker, she runs into some problems.
Amy, it's the good yogurt. It's the yummy one. Let's try that one more time. Okay. All right, here. Just stay.
Honey, what you doing here?
Oh, you know, snack time's always tricky, so you might want to give her 10 minutes of TV, help her ease into the yogurt.
Okay.
Don't worry. got your back, baby.
Okay, you know what? I don't need my back to be got. I got this.
Babe, you might want to just...
What? No?
But
all right, honey, don't backseat parent me, man.
She's home from the office. Don't backseat parent me, man. Hanna Rosen, what's your take on it? I mean, there's something going on here. How are people dealing with it? How are men, women, couples? Are we just absorbing this and rolling on, or is it a problem?
I love that sitcom just for its political implications. Yeah. I mean, that's the wrong reason to love a sitcom. But it's really one of the first extended portrayals of a non-emasculated stay-at-home dad that we have. And, you know, his wife still thinks he's hot. He's really competent with the baby. It's really, really helpful to have a role model like that because women get them all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. Anytime women do anything new, they have like Murphy Brown or Carrie Bradshaw or like, you know, some sitcom devoted to it. So I really like it.
But life is not a sitcom exactly.
No, I mean, I think that some couples do ease into this and welcome it, but it is a marriage system that's existed for years and years. And, you know, Stephanie is the great expert on the complicated arrangements that people have made throughout history. Nonetheless, I think, you know, some men have a hard time with it, but less and less so. I mean, the word I hear and the kind of letters I get after I write this book are actually that I've exaggerated the extent to which this is difficult for younger men, and particularly younger progressive men. You know, they've written me and said, like, you're way too much of a downer on this thing. Like, it's actually okay. Like, we can handle it. It's actually good for us. You know, we are part of this, you know, new culture of men, and that's okay. So I don't really know. We'll see.
Lots of angles on this. Emily writes to us online while we're talking to here. She says, what bothers me as a married, pregnant woman is that I have no choice but to keep working. She says, if I did, I'd take a civilized year off to give my child a healthy start. If I had a real choice, I'd take 5 years off, she says. And here's another listener. Shag says, flexibility, says this is a buzzword for part-time work with zero or crappy benefits. We'll look at that. Steve in Evansville, Indiana. Steve, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Been listening to the conversation, and I felt like I had a perspective to offer for you.
Please.
42 years old. I'm currently at home with my 3-year-old, and my wife works. Of course, I would rather be working, but it just doesn't seem like there's the opportunity out there that, you know, is available to, well, for example, my parents.
Mm-hmm.
My dad worked, you know, and made enough money that my mom never had to go to work.
Right.
And this is an experience, I think, for a lot of people in my generation.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, from earlier generations, it seems like this wave of women's voices in culture, you know, demanding better opportunities has been sort of like rising my whole life.
How's it leave you feeling, Steve? Do you still feel, you know, well, how do you feel about it?
Well, I think there's good and bad that comes out of it. You know, I think there's sometimes, you know, As this wave sort of grows and washes over our culture, it's going to bring some bad things with it. And I think we've all seen, you know, some examples of that. But there's also good things. I mean, equality is a good thing. And,
mm-hmm.
and men being more involved in their families is always a good thing. But if it comes at the detriment of being able to earn a living, you know, then, you know, where do you draw the line?
Yeah. I mean, everybody needs to make a living. And how about at home? Do you feel like you understand your role in this new situation you're in or not?
that's sort of a long-term discussion.
Yeah.
I don't know. Look, I'm not sure if I've understood my role to this point in 42 years. So.
Hey, you know, your laughter tells us a lot. We'll meditate on that, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Thank you, Steve, in Evansville. Sarah in Belmont, Massachusetts. Sarah, you're on.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd just like to say that I really don't agree with Hanna Rosen's hypothesis. I mean, she seems to focus too much on the fact that many more women are getting educated than men in college level and are doing better, getting A's, whereas men are getting C's and so on and so forth. But if you look at the top levels of achievement and entrepreneurship, it's men who are doing everything. I mean, if you look at the past, say, 30 years, they... things that have changed our culture and, in fact, changed the world, like Apple, Microsoft, Google, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook,
Yeah, Sarah, we take your point. I've just got a couple more minutes here. We're going to talk about the debates in a second, the debate. But Stephanie Kuntz, this goes to your observation that you've still got a lot of men with a lot of throw weight in this economy, Sarah points to. And, I mean, you wrote the wonderful book, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique in American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. But here we are now, you know, trying to figure out who's being held back or propelled forward by what mystique in 2012. What do you say, Stephanie?
Well, I would say that both men and women are being held back by an increasingly unequal economy that is making choices and adaptation very difficult for both of them. When you look
unequal, not between gender, but you mean in general, just
in general,
inequality in our overall economy.
Right. And then, for example, when you look at the low-income people and the lower working-class people, I think men and women are both having trouble adjusting, again, in different gender ways, but equally difficult. You have the men who have trouble who react to these changes by avoiding marriage and responsibility, by acting out as sort of reasserting a compensatory masculinity. You have many women who also are perpetuating the old gender ideas by seeing motherhood as a substitute for the achievements. High school graduation and college graduation rates are low among both sexes in there, and of course women are still more likely to be poor. The point I'd like to make, but it's interesting that even in very working class and the least educated men, those who do make the adjustment to get married and to be willing to work with a woman who earns as much, if not more, are actually doing more housework and childcare. They've increased it as much as highly educated men have. Today, 72% of women and 74% of women disagree that women should return to their traditional roles. So this is a gender revolution. It's occurring a little more slowly among men than women, but it's occurring among both.
Hey, Stephanie Kuntz, author of A Strange Stirring, with us there from Evergreen State College in Washington State. It's always great to have you. Hannah Rosin, in a word, what have we got here? Are we headed toward equality, matriarchy, patriarchy, just dressed up differently?
I'll take convergence for the moment. We can agree on that.
Convergence, which implies a kind of equality.
I'll take that.
If we take it up. Hannah Rosin, author of the book getting a lot of attention, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Hannah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll look ahead with James Fallows to tonight's presidential debate in Denver. This is On Point. Tonight, President Barack Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney face off in the first of three presidential debates. Latest poll numbers show Obama with a lead, but hardly out of reach. Joining me now from Washington, James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. His big essay, Slugfest, in the September issue of The Atlantic, breaks down what each candidate needs to do and what they should be wary of. James Fallows, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
So is it ideas? Is it posture? Is it the glint in the eye? What's the bottom line in presidential debating?
It seems, for better or worse, that the effect of debates is almost never in the ideas and certainly not in the policy points. That as people look back on the debates that made a difference or not, it's matters of personal style, of body language, of carriage, of confidence, of response under pressure, that seems to have made people feel more comfortable with Ronald Reagan than Jimmy Carter in 1980, John Kennedy rather than Richard Nixon in 1960, and so on.
So what does that say about these two men, Barack Obama, Mitt Romney? They're going to be head-to-head for the first time. I think it's been years since they shared a stage. In those terms, what do you see coming?
Well, I think that for Governor Romney, there's both an upside and a downside. The upside is that the first debate between a challenger and an incumbent president has traditionally given an edge to the challenger just because it's so rare for an incumbent president to stand on equal footing with anybody else. So
anybody at all, yeah.
Anybody at all, right. And I think, in fact, this is the only time during a president's term when he ever is on any kind of footing of equality with another American citizen. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's other foreign heads of state.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the chance for challengers to sort of make their first presentation and say, okay, look at me as I'm matched up against the guy you've been familiar with for the last few years. The drawback for Governor Romney in particular is that through his relative, surprisingly long debating career, he's been pretty good when prepared on message, giving what he knows to be the attack line he has in mind. He has often made mistakes when caught by the unexpected or the out-of-the-blue improvisation, and that's when we get things like the $10,000 bet and going and touching
with Rick Perry
and, mm-hmm. and the rest. So I guess the Romney campaign is trying to think of everything that might come up, and the Obama campaign is trying to think of other things.
Well, I suppose that's a lot to think of. On the other hand, he has a record that's not just 4 years ago when Barack Obama could paint a picture of almost anything. Now there are 3.5, 4 years. It's not a total surprise what that record is. That sounds like it might give Mitt Romney a good basis to stand on.
Yes, and I think that he has a more competent crew around him than you might guess from the last month or so of his campaign. And I'm sure they're anticipating all of the attack lines of both the moderator, Jim Lehrer, and that President Obama, in a more restrained presidential way, will be delivering to Governor Romney. So I'm sure that they've worked on those. And from the president's point of view, his great advantage, of course, is that 4 years ago when debating against Hillary Clinton, he didn't really know that much about world affairs. And now he's been, of course, immersed in that for the last 4 years. He has the augustness of the presidency, and he has mainly to contain the occasional superciliousness that has come through in some of his debates 4 years ago. And I'm sure
you're likely likable enough, Hillary kind of comment.
Indeed, yes. That was sort of the low point of his debating career back in 2008.
So, but when we look at it as sort of the body language, the carriage issue that you say can be such a big deal here, what about these two, paired up in that way?
Mitt Romney was surprisingly good at that in two of his probably most important debate encounters. One was back with Edward Kennedy back at 18 years ago, when, of course,
challenging Edward Kennedy for the Massachusetts Senate seat.
Massachusetts, mm-hmm. yes. And he lost the election badly, and he was seen as not having really beaten Kennedy in any of the debates. But it was striking to me that, especially in the first debate, he had thought of exactly the right way to approach Kennedy, both in personal style and in language. The language was, everybody recognizes the service of Senator Kennedy and the Kennedy family. That's great, but it's time for something new. And he tried to present himself as the new business-oriented then, man in his 40s approach. And again, in the primaries this year against his Republican opponents, he was able to usually sort of position himself as the calm, half-amused father figure, watching as all these other people just squabbled among
right.
themselves.
Right.
He won't be able to do quite that against a sitting president, but I'm sure he will try to seem calm, confident, and collected. And Obama, the main thing he wants to seem is optimistic and in control and not defensive or beleaguered.
Well, for Romney, what's the mix you think might work for him of aggression and friendliness? I mean, I don't know. Today, I think I heard is Barack Obama and his wife Michelle's anniversary. Is he going to give anniversary greetings to the president or come out attack dog? Or both?
Yeah, probably both. For my money, and I'm speaking as a one-time Democratic staff member, I think the Romney campaign has been most effective when they've depersonalized the attack, as he did against Edward Kennedy long ago, and saying, nobody has any ill will towards President Obama. We all recognize that these have been hard problems he's been dealing with, but his solutions haven't worked. And therefore, let's go on to my other solutions, which he will probably have to give more details of than he's been doing in the last few months. So I think that especially in the face-to-face with an incumbent president, his ideal mode is respectful, but saying, let's look forward, as opposed to any of the personal hostility we saw during some of the Republican primary debates.
It has not been an easy term for Barack Obama. There's been plenty of hostility all around. Mitt Romney has made very harsh attacks on the president, and there have been harsh attacks in return. But how does the president stand there with a record that's, debatable behind him? Certainly people debate it all the time. How does he avoid getting defensive or tense if Romney goes at that, pounding on that?
Well, probably the ability to answer that question is why Barack Obama is a one-term president and potentially a two-term president, and neither you nor I or anybody else listening is, that he has figured out how he can present a smiling, unthreatening, and yet confident demeanor and say, things have been tough, but we're going to try to look ahead. And so I think that that is probably the body chemistry, body language, personality calculus that partly may be innate to him, but partly is what he should be working on with his advisors of how to seem aware of the hardships for many people and taking them seriously, but saying, look, things are going to be okay. Bill Clinton did that during the convention, but of course, he's a very different style from Barack Obama.
Is there a debate that most closely parallels this one, or is it one of a kind, Jim?
Well, I think that each campaign would answer that in a different way. For the Republican campaign, what they are dreaming of is the sole 1980 debate between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter, where the polls were neck and neck despite everything that was going badly for Carter. But in that one debate a week before the election, people apparently felt comfortable enough with Governor Reagan to say, we don't like what Carter's doing, we're going to take this new person. I think for the Obama campaign, they're looking for something like the Clinton-Dole encounters of 1996, where Clinton was vulnerable, but he's able to sort of position Dole is not really what people wanted.
Well, we'll be tuning in for the first of three. And of course, many people beginning to vote already. So by the time the second and third debates come around, it'll be too late for a lot of them, Jim. This really matters.
It's true. And let's not forget Paul Ryan and Joe Biden in Kentucky, which should be fun in its own right.
Fun in its own right. Absolutely. James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic. Jim, thank you so much, as always, for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today. You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.